Mazi, for inviting me to give a talk, and also for everyone to show up on a Saturday morning. I'm extremely impressed. So I hope this is going to be worth your time. So the first thing I'd like to say is that all this talk is based on ideas that I discussed with these wonderful people. And I'd like to single out Claudia, who's not here, but much of the work that I'm going to discuss was done in collaboration with her. So let me start by singling out Claudia in this CMV network of people. So I think ever since I started my PhD, every time that I hear the word superluminal, usually I find that cosmologists get quite nervous and they're kind of in denial and say, well, whenever I find some superluminality, let me focus on a region in parameter space of the theory where I can always choose CS to be smaller than one and I don't have to worry about things. But a field theory strategist is a lot different from that. What that person says is, well, you know, let me start by looking at what it means in terms of the fundamental properties of the theory. And so whenever we're in the position of evaluating perturbation theory in this era of data-driven cosmologies, what we want is to use a language by which we're able to decode observational data, and the preferred language is effective field theory. We can use different notions of effective field theory. We can either use the effective field theory for zeta, which is this co-moving curvature perturbation to which observations are directly related to, or we can also use this very popular and really powerful tool that is called the effective field theory for inflation, which is based on the dynamics of this Goldstone mode pi, which is associated with the breaking of time translational invariance in the theory. And so obviously these are related. There's a field redefinition, a gauge transformation between both languages. And the whole point is that we should use that effective field theory language, whichever zeta or pi variable that we start to choose our analysis with, and decode observations. The key point is that most of the times what we're agnostic is about what the background is doing. So what we want is to use the cosmological data to give direct access to perturbations to learn something about the fundamental properties of the background and therefore of the theory. This is not just at the level of early universe. Effective field theories are also used whenever we want to understand, for example, screening mechanisms. And I think main of the issues that we've been discussing is really related to these dichotomies related to the Weinstein mechanism. So what happens is that in the interesting regime, whenever we want to look at screening mechanisms, we're looking at the strongly coupled physics at the level of the background. And that's directly related to weakly coupled physics at the level of the perturbations. So that's what's allowing us to make some predictions at the level of the theory. Because otherwise, if it was just strongly coupled all the way through, it would be very hard to get predictions from that. So it seems to me that this issue on superluminalities, and as well as others, are actually a variant of what we can call a bottom-up approach that's allowing us to ask more fundamental questions about the theory. So really, what we find to be the fundamental, the key principles of which these theories should be propagating is the notion of causality, unitarity, and naturalness. And sometimes the fact that we find what could have been pathologies, they might not actually be pathologies at all. That might just mean that we need to understand better how these effective field theories are constructed. So even before we ask the question, can the theory propagate viable phenomenology, by which we mean, can we use this theory to decode observational data and then run back to the parameters of the theory and basically constrain them on the basis of data? Actually, one of the questions we can ask is whether the theory is defined and well-defined in the first place, and whether we understand how to make the best use of these effective field theories. So just a healthy warning, this talk is more of an exploration, a humble exploration of ideas. So just to start the talk, I'm going to be discussing the Weinstein effect, and I think that's at the core of all these issues that we've been discussing. Then I'm going to discuss the paper with Claudia in aspects of quantum effects, whether we can trust these operators that are irrelevant and that we want them to be large to have these Weinstein screening, whether we can make sense of them within a quantum effective field theory picture. And then I'm going to mention some things that we've been very used to deal with in cosmological perturbation theory, And that, according to everything that we've learned on standard effective field theory, tools should actually leave us very nervous. And then I'm going to end with a short summary. So this Weinstein mechanism is this wonderful thing that allows us to investigate this rich phenomenology in these theories. The whole point is that standard effective field theory rules don't apply. They imply actually a certain rearrangement of the rules, which are based on a hierarchy between several derivatives acting on the background. The main point is that once we use the background field method, by which I mean we split the field into a background and some small perturbation, once we evaluate these kinetic metrics, what we find is that there's going to be very large deformations of that usual standard canonical kinetic term. And this is a background dependent statement. Typical examples would have been P of X models, where X is basically the kinetic term, which is just being divided here by the strong coupling scale for dimensionless reasons. And that's endowed with the shift symmetry. So this embodies a class of models. And then we also have Galileans, which are embedded with the Galilean symmetry, and a specific subset of those can even have an extra hidden symmetry. So the problem is all these models, they allow for large background configurations, which restructure what we mean by effective field theory rules. Also, whenever we start talking about these theories, we start with a given P of X theory or a given Galilean theory. And this is naive, and it actually encodes many approximations that we're doing. So what the effective field theory rules tell us is that we should identify the relevant degrees of freedom and write down all the operators which respect those low energy symmetries. So even when we start with a finite form for the operators, that's a very naive thing to do. And actually that's one of the things that presumably we should be revisiting. But let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that we start with the generic P of X theory, and then we use the background field method. So we start calculating what's the kinetic matrix to which the quantum fluctuations are going to respond to. And then the quadratic action for fluctuations is going to be basically given by the usual form. For a P of X model, we know what the Z mu nu is built of. It's basically built out of first order derivatives acting on the scalar field. When the Z is very large, or at least one eigenvalue of this kinetic matrix becomes large, then the interactions are so large that they redress all these operators. And that's when the Weinstein mechanism needs to be taken into account in defining the field theory rules. So a simple example is in DBI inflation. So in DBI inflation, what we have is a single field model, which is rolling down the potential, which can actually be quite large, but there's basically a limiting speed of sound of fluctuations because it's represented by a Lagrangian that has encoded a square root. So what that implies is that there's a maximum speed that that field can move. And the most interesting regime is when that speed here in the X is very comparable to one. So that speed is almost as large as a strong coupling scale. That's usually related with large non-Gaussianities, which I'm not going to talk to discuss for this talk. But usually that's the theory that we'll like to make sense of whenever it's in the strongly coupled regime. Now, there are other situations, namely for late time universe phenomenology, in which we like to also make sense of these theories that can have very large kinetic operators. So let's suppose that we start again with the P of X theory, and then we focus on radial directions for evaluating the matrix elements of the Z mu nu. What we find is that if there's a big lump that is sourcing the background configuration for this field, there's a Lorentz breaking of this theory. And actually, if we analyze the stability requirements of this theory, it's quite generic to find these superluminalities, which is also tied to the fact that the Weinstein mechanism is so powerful that it's basically shifting all your notions of what would be canonical kinetic terms and adding really relevant and important contributions. Galileans are another example. Suppose that we start with the cubic Galilean and we stop the derivative expansion there, and then we couple these Galilean to a very large background configuration, which could have been a point source, for example. What this means is that if I solve for the equations of motion, I'm going to find for spherically symmetric solutions, I'm going to find that the Z mu nu that affects both the causal structure of the theory as well as the kinetic structure of the perturbations, it's going to acquire very large background values. So these box phi, these second order derivatives, so in P of X would have been first order derivatives, and in Galois these second order derivatives, is actually going to be quite large. And if we calculate the radial speed of fluctuations, they are very easily shown that they can admit superluminal profiles. And so the presence of superluminalities here are tied with the fact that we can have an effective screening, which means that because we have very large background configurations, the freezing of these modes at short distance physics is basically at the heart of having an effective Weinstein screening. So the Weinstein radius here is basically telling us when these effects become dominant. And what we want is to find an effective field theory description that goes right from the Weinstein radius and inside it. Another consequence, and that's why they're so good, these models, is because they basically say that we can hide these extra degrees of freedom just because of the Weinstein screening. So a way of understanding this, again, we start with the same model. What we find is that because the kinetic structure is modified, we can do a trick, which is not necessary, but it's a convenient way of thinking about these theories, which is that the strong coupling scale that appears here actually becomes redressed because of this large background. And when that happens, what we find is that there's a raising of the scale at which perturbative unitarity would be lost. So as a point of principle, we start with a lambda scale that we believe that perturbative unitarity here is going to be lost, and then we need to take into account the loop corrections. But actually, because of that large background configuration, we're able to go up to the scale lambda star, which is parametrically different, and that's one of the key things in these theories, from the cutoff scale. So the cutoff scale could be diagnosed by a number of ways. One way would have been, well, is there a ghost in the theory? And if so, at what scale does that come in? It could be used to estimate what this lambda C is, or it could be just the lightest particle that hasn't been included in the particle spectrum of the theory. So the whole point is that we're able to make nice phenomenology of the theory up to these scales. So lambda C here is the maximum energy scale up to which I expect the theory to be valid. I'm not assuming that this is actually the cutoff of the theory. I'm assuming implicitly that the fact that we lose perturbative unitarity at this scale doesn't necessarily mean that the theory makes no more sense beyond that scale. It just means that my ability to calculate loops it could be that some scales it's actually here, but I'm allowing myself to be away from that regime. So suppose that I identify lambda C to be lambda, for example, and not actually lambda star.
In these Weinstein stories was always that maybe plus perturbative unitarity breaks down to lambda. Maybe there's some non-perturbative resummation method that makes sense of the theory above lambda.
Are you mean sort of logic safety?
We don't know.
Yeah, but I think that's the answer.
That's the running assumption, right? So there's a non-perturbative resummation method or something above lambda. So then you say, let's suppose the theory really breaks non-perturbative unitarity at lambda C. Then you can have the Weinstein. Because now you see around background, I'm just raising the scale. That's the lot.
But I don't need to think about cutoffs. Usually, when we talk about cutoffs, what do you mean is the scale that perturbative unitarity is down.
Right, so what these theories are telling us is that, at least in these circumstances, that wouldn't have been true. Because I could have then identified these lambda C could have been here, and then I wouldn't have been able to go further into those energy scales.
Perturbation theory breaks down lambda star.
Right.
We all agree on that.
Yes.
The assumption is that there is some UV completion of this theory up to lambda C, and which there are no new states before lambda c.
So lambda c could have been like, you know, a very heavy particle that I haven't included in this Lagrangian.
Of course, we don't have that thing, right? But that was always the assumption that you could then have to find something.
But that cannot be a symbolic state.
It's not, but we don't know
what it is. We're completely agnostic of what this physics here would have been.
Yeah, but I think it's more about saying that lambda c is stuff that's not in your theory. Everything else is already in your theory. It's just maybe not perturbated.
Well, not necessarily in that action. But
when you're in the domain, it's not. But for instance, lambda c, in principle, forget about gravity for a second. Lambda c could be even infinite. No?
Yes.
Because
we don't know.
This kind of logic reminds us of a dilaton, in which all mass scales depend on the background of the dilaton, and so lambda star fluctuates in the dilaton. But then when you go to your decomposition, it's a CFD, and so you can extrapolate things.
That's right. So these scales shouldn't depend on what the background is doing, but lambda star will.
I think that was more or less the initial idea in the space. The low equilibrium, there was conformal symmetry. So maybe it's like something in breaking of conformal symmetry. Maybe there is no fundamental lambda c.
Yeah, so maybe that's right. So maybe lambda c is infinite. Of course, it's not infinite because it's a.
Because we don't argue in that way.
But it's not your paper.
You know it's not infinite in terms of fact.
So I'd like to discuss is actually that we're making sense of these background-dependent statements in which.
So is the idea that there's some non-perturbativeness that is mentioned which you can do beyond lambda star using this action or not?
We don't know, right? So as a point of principle, what we want to make. The hope is that there should be some technique by which you make sense of the theory beyond lambda star. So it's not really the cutoff. That's right. That's right.
Beyond any scale, there is some technique which makes sense of the theory. So I don't think that, there is some scale at which there is nothing. So in that sense,
right.
What is the meaning of lambda c?
It's a matter of what you call the assumption is there's no new poles, no new particles.
But if there's a broad pole, if the particles are unstable, if there's a broad pole.
Yeah, maybe that's okay.
But that's more or less always.
You probably couldn't even trust the theory at that lambda, right? Or at least you'd have to include it there.
Around curved background, I know there's no new particle at lambda, right? Around flat background, maybe there's a new particle, but because lambda is really the scale where my theory goes down around flat background. So
no.
It doesn't prevent from breaking at high scale around curved background. I think that was
it depends on.
Yeah, but the theory doesn't break on the perturbative summation break stuff, so you have to use an imperative.
Let's discuss a concrete example. Let's really pick a CFT, which has a modular space, that conformal symmetry is spontaneously built, like anything positive and real. Depending on the background, there is a different cutoff scale. And this cutoff scale is exactly on each background, it is shaded with integrating out series with the cutoff, it's shaded integrating out some massive particles. And the mass of these particles depends on the background itself. So it's totally fine that for different backgrounds you have different cutoffs, and this cutoff is associated with mass of some quasi-stable particles. So I'm not sure where this.
If that works, that's great. That's one possible.
I guess one way of reconciling all this is that the way we're defining lambda c, so the cutoff. It doesn't really depend on what the background is doing. It's whatever it is, and it depends on what the UV completion of the theory is going to be. Whereas the lambda is something that is going to be background dependent. So whatever my background is going to be doing, it can raise or even lower the strong coupling scale. So that's we're basically assuming that they're parametrically different, strong coupling scale and cutoff. So the question I'd like to address is whether we can trust these irrelevant deformations of the kinetic term in the first place. We can get some estimates of when perturbation theory can break down whenever we assume that these irrelevant the operators are important by calculating the one-loop effective action. And what that amounts to is to calculating the log of a functional determinant of a relatively complicated operator. Now, fortunately, the result is known, and the UV divergences, which are the ones that we want to focus on, can be organized as a Seeley-DeWitt expansion, which is basically an expansion in powers of curvature built out of the covariant covariant metric associated with this union. So the point is that we can start organizing all these derivatives in terms of power laws and what would have been the logarithmic divergences. And if we focus on the log divergences, so I'm going to talk about the power laws later on, but if we focus just on these log divergences, and if we use the dimensional regularization, the answer is relatively simple. All I need to do to calculate quantum corrections at one loop using the one-loop effective action, and this is a generalization of the Coleman-Weigler potential arguments, is actually to calculate these curvature quantities, which are built out of this covariant effective metric that is related to this mu nu. So the idea, like was mentioned yesterday, is that we want to make sure that the foliation in parameter space is such that the curvature, the locally defined curvature here, is extremely small for the field to actually be able to feel that and then be corrected at the level of effective field theory, Lagrangian. And so a way of estimating when your perturbation theory breaks down in that perturbative expansion is to say, let me compare what's the size of these operators with respect to the original Lagrangian. Do I find something that allows me to be in control of the quantum corrections or not? So the point is that Z mu nu for P of X theories, as we've seen, depends on first order derivative of the fields. So if we calculate things like curvature quantities, it's going to include at least two derivatives acting on the scalar field. So we see here that at least the way that the perturbative expansion in this effective field theory is going to be organized is going to be based on a hierarchy between derivatives acting on the background. So let's go back to the DBI inflation model.
Sorry, before you go, can I ask you a question? Can you go back one time?
Yes.
So the fact that in one loop, if you want, it's an accident of the one loop calculation that you can write the result in terms of curvature invariance of that effective metric, in the sense that interactions, self-interactions of fluctuations, which would be important at two loops, let's say, do not respect that diff invariance, meaning that they do not depend just in a diff invariant way on that effective metric. They depend on other quantities that depend on the background scalar. So I'm wondering whether there are some accidental cancellations at one loop that make the effects that you are looking for smaller at one loop than at two loops.
Yeah, so later on, I'm going to make the argument that all loops. Okay. And even focusing on the power law divergences, which could be sensitive to all these things that we're not taking into account. So this is a way of just estimating where the perturbative expansion could break down, but it's definitely not the best method, and it's not taking into account all the effects. So going back to the DBI inflation model, as I was saying, the most interesting regime from the phenomenology point of view is when we start focusing on the fact that X can be very close to one, and then we can't stop this derivative expansion in phi dot. And the usual statement that is done in the literature is that in DBI, we can have the speed of the field to be quite large, provided that at least some measure of the acceleration of that field is kept small. And at least with the one-loop effective action, we can be slightly more precise about what we mean by small.
But in this case, it's basically just a symmetry of C, right? Geometrically, it's in the brain, or there is a boost invariance. So you can boost the brain, it's the same background. It's related by symmetry to the
ground. So what I'm trying to say is that if I use the fact that the acceleration of the field was small as a point of principle, on those arguments, I'll get a 1 here. I could have gotten a 1. I could have said, well, the acceleration needs to be very small. I'm not allowed to have a perturbative expansion where I could add some other terms and then make them respect the symmetry, and then the acceleration would be small. All I'm trying to say is that at least with the one-loop effective action, we're able to resum the one-loop effects in a way that phi double dot over lambda cubed, which would be this measure of acceleration, needs to be much smaller than what would be the speed of sound to the power of 3, which is something that I wouldn't have access hadn't I done this resummation of one loop effects. And then we can use the Planck data to say, well, there's actually some constraints on DBI inflation that constrain the value of the speed of sound, which is basically the inverse of this Lorentz contraction factor. And what I learn is that there's a huge hierarchy, at least three orders of magnitude. And while I'm allowed to be on the regime where phi dot is comparable to lambda squared, I need to make sure that on the derivative expansion that I write down, that the scalar field acceleration is actually kept smaller than the strong coupling scale by at least three orders of magnitude. And this is something that I couldn't have anticipated without doing a one loop calculation.
But it is not the same, you would not get the same estimate if you look at the geometric invariance of the brain. So is the statement that is like the extrinsic curvature is smaller?
Exactly, exactly. So that will be identified with the right measure to quantify the acceleration. But for that to be true, I would have to go to the higher dimensional picture and actually understand how that works. So we actually did that calculation, and it agrees perfectly.
Yeah, I think that's one of those cases where in the decision at DIMRAC, even if you do DIMRAC, if you do the one loop, you get the contribution gap breaks the DBI symmetry.
And that's because it's a nonlinear realized symmetry at the four-dimensional level.
Because it's nonlinear symmetry, and then this is another thing that you have to.
But that's right. You can preserve this.
Yeah, of course you can preserve it. Yeah, that's the point. But if
you need to modify at least what you mean by the one loop effective action by taking into account the right measure.
Yeah, but that's always the case. Yeah.
But is the difference, is it actually DBI or is it just some give X that happens to the effect?
Okay, so the other way of seeing the powerfulness of these methods, but just by calculating one loop effective action, is actually in the situation in which you have screening. What this allows us to do is to say that we can actually go beyond what we call the radius, the Weinstein radius, and make sense of the theory up to some length scale where the UV effects are actually going to kick in. So if we calculate the quantum corrections with this curvature formula, and if we focus on spherically symmetric backgrounds, what we find is that we can go actually inside the Weinstein radius where quantum effects can be under control, at least using this one loop effective action analysis, up to some minimum scale up to which quantum effects become so important that I'll have to take them into account. So at least I can trust the effective field theory for screening up to some length scales here.
So this arm in EFT, is that lambda C or lambda star?
So this is going to depend on lambda because at this point I'm completely agnostic about what lambda C is. But as a point of principle, when you for example, you keep track of the power laws, then that information is going to include whatever scale kicks in.
Lambda star is Armin EFT in your.
You can write it as lambda star as well. Well, in terms of lambda, it depends whether you want to put the background information there or not.
Can I come back to a couple of lines? So in DBI, you can implement DIMRAC such as preserves nonlinear as well.
If you do this, if you do the background field effective method, and you follow and you keep the term that you're keeping track of, right? The log term.
It's not going to preserve the symmetry.
Because I can write effective action for the brain in D plus one dimensions. So
yes.
This is a D.
Oh, yes, that you can do, that's right. But then you have to introduce other fields to make that, and then.
If you do this at
one brain,
yes,
like any dimension, and if you kind of do that, that brain from the direct preserves. That's exactly what we're doing in Nambu-Goto, for instance.
Yeah,
so true. It is Nambu-Goto, but yeah, when it was trained, so it was crucial to work with this image, which is that Nambu-Goto and Lorentz to produce.
No, I don't think anybody is disputing that. Then why do you have this non-Lorentz invariant?
No, but that's on the summary counter. Exactly, you're not allowed to add it if you use it in the red. So that counter term, if you want to preserve integrability, you want to add the counter term. But so from doing one loop calculation, you don't get that one exactly because this counter term is forbidden by the nearest point.
So that was not in red that you were using to get that?
No, that's a different one.
Now, of course, there's, you know, with this one loop effective action, there's still some questions that we need to ask. And an inevitability of doing quantum corrections is that usually we are going to introduce ghosts. So let me focus on this example, which was discussed to some length yesterday, which is just x plus x squared. Remember that x is just a kinetic term. If we do this one loop effective action and again focus on the log running, we find operators which are going to disturb the special structure that we started with. What that means is that they're going to give basically higher order derivative operators, which are going to signal the presence of a ghost. Of course, the relevant question to ask here is not so much whether there's a ghost, but at which scale the ghost is going to come in. So when we work out the mass of the ghost, again, doing the background field method, and we focus on the operator that is high order derivative, what we find is that we can estimate the ghost, the energy at which that ghost appears, by basically these terms. So it's going to be the strong coupling scale to the fourth power divided by what the background is going to be doing. Now, this is a P of X model. As we've seen, the acceleration is such that it's much smaller than the strong coupling scale to the appropriate power. So what this means is that I can still make sense of the quantum corrections, and they're perfectly under control, and they don't introduce a ghost up to some energy scale, which is parametrically larger than the strong coupling scale. So phenomenology here is still completely viable, and I can trust the theory even when I put quantum corrections inside. Now, of course, the whole problem comes when we start coupling this theory to high energy degrees of freedom. So let's consider these two field models. Let's consider that we start with a P of X model and you introduce a very heavy field. So mass here is much larger than lambda, the strong coupling scale, and I make this field couple to my original field, for example, through that coupling. It's just a toy model.
So how do you get a ghost from a P of X theory? I guess I was confused. So with Galileo, just for P of X, where is the ghost?
So in P of X, once we start calculating the quantum effects at the one loop effective action, we're basically going to obtain is these curvature quantities, which are built out of Z. So Z already includes at least first order derivatives. So curvature quantities built out of that metric would necessarily involve at least two derivatives acting on the scalar field. So once we calculate the equations of motion, it will make sure they're non-zero. So those terms are not irrelevant at the level of the Lagrangian, then that means that they're signaling the presence of a ghost degree of freedom.
But isn't it automatic that somehow that ghost is beyond the cutoff? Because is the cutoff or the strong
coupling scale? Or the strong coupling scale.
Because if the strong coupling scale tells you that below the strong coupling scale, the theory is really coupled, how can you inject new degrees of freedom?
I'm just saying that this could have been one criticism, and I think I think it's easy to address that. Exactly. I could have also just said that, but we can also do a calculation to show explicitly that's what happens. So it's a bit problematic because you start also calculating loop diagrams. And once you do that, what you find is that the whole thing is disturbed. So the P of X model that you started with, as soon as you start coupling it to a very massive field, you start introducing operators which are infinitesimally close to the ones that you started with. And so that's quite problematic. And it's a multi-parameterized way of saying how many couplings, how many different couplings I have, and what can I add to this structure. So because these one loop corrections correct the classical operators as a point of principle, and we're introducing this mass, which is a way of seeing how much UV sensitivity my theory has, of course it's problematic. And there's a further improvement that can be made using exact renormalization group methods. What this does is basically a perturbative analysis, but that it's non-perturbative at the same time. So what this does is basically that I want to study what the flow of the dual Lagrangian my P of X model is once I flow from the ultraviolet right to the infrared. I need to choose some regulator. This is a given for the purposes of this talk. So this was already intensely studied, what kind of regulators we'd have to use. And it's extremely hard to solve this exact renormalization group equation. And the whole point is that what we'll like to do is to basically start the whole analysis at the cutoff theory and start resumming all the diagrams that come into the loops down to the infrared and analyze what the low energy theory would be and whether it would pick up UV-dependent factors. operators. And so it's extremely hard to solve. But instead of just asking very generically what the flow of the Lagrangian is, we can at least ask a slightly simpler question, which is, are there any regimes in the field theory where the quantum corrections are not going to spoil the classical productivity of the model? And here we're going to be focusing on the power laws as the surrogate for what high energy physics is doing. So whatever UV sector the theory can have, we can trace back that dependence. And just by dimensional analysis, it's easy to see that the flow of the Lagrangian can be as large as lambda c to the fourth. Okay, so this would be a power law divergence. And it would be very worrying because it would mean that all these operators would start changing at the scale which would be extremely, extremely small. And so they would be detected by the effective field theory. If we focus again on these higher derivative terms, on these very large interactions, and if we are allowed to be deep inside the Weinstein radius, it turns out that this resummation of loop effects that mixes both the field propagating inside the loop as well as these matter fields that can be coupled to the field at the scale lambda c, which is the scale of new physics, what we find is something miraculous, that there's some kind of Weinstein screening mechanism at the quantum level. So the fact that Weinstein screening is so powerful, it means that it's going to redress all your interactions in such a way that what would have been an extremely bad divergence, a lambda c to the fourth, is actually suppressed. Now, of course, this is a statement only deep inside the Weinstein radius, when we can make sure that all the dominant contributions for that exact renormalization group equation is actually going to be dominated by what could have been not necessarily all the matrix elements, but at least the maximum value for Z, which, again, by assumption, is something that is very large. Now, again, this is not the end of the story, right? So we don't want just to make sure that the theory makes sense deep inside the Weinstein radius. Away from that Weinstein radius, it should also make sense, because I need to get there in the first place. So that's something that it's very hard to do. But at least this gives us some suggestion that these theories might be okay, just because the Weinstein mechanism not only operates at the classical level to imply the screening of the classical degrees of freedom, but also at the quantum level. And at least it's telling us that existence of Gaussian duality transformations, like they're going to be discussed later on, might be insightful for these issues.
So are you using the term Weinstein mechanism as some sort of resummation of the RG group equation here?
So the RG equation is already resumming all these loop effects.
What I'm doing is saying I'm
deep inside the Weinstein radius, such that these kinetic redressing.
In RG, there is no radius, so you're talking about the momentum space or energy space.
What I'm saying is that the Z mu nu is extremely large. So right. By that I mean being very, very deep inside the Weinstein radius. That's right. What I mean. I'm saying that the kinetic redressing is actually the dominant effect. And that's the regime in which I'm able to do these estimates on the basis of the exact renormalization
group. The same way that people solve spherical field equations to get the field profile in the spherical coordinates, for example, could you actually find the solution instead of doing the estimates? I mean, basically, can you solve the RG equation?
It's extremely hard. That's what I was trying to say. I need to focus on this regime to get an estimate, because solving the exact renormalization group in all the regime of the theory is extremely hard. Either these kinetic interactions are the dominant thing and you throw away all the other possibilities, or they're basically non-existent, in which case you're always going to get quantum corrections that are always very small. But it's very, very hard to do something in between. So I just wanted to finish with what I think needs to be some kind of redressing of normal rules that we see in effective field theories that we should be uncomfortable with, and actually we're not, because deep down we know that all these theories have this gravitational setup, and they should really be regarded as something that is not just a scalar field theory, but something that encodes very subtle information. So if we remain agnostic about what causes inflation, we can write, as I said, either an action in terms of zeta, which is this co-moving curvature perturbation, so it's the perturbation of the locally defined scale factor directly mapped to the temperature and isotropies in the microwave sky. If I look at the cubic action, and I can basically write this action regardless of the order in slow roll that I'm doing the calculation. So this action is exact in slow roll and is just perturbative in this co-moving curvature perturbation zeta. I can also do the same calculation using the effective field theory, which is extremely useful within the decoupling limit, by which we're basically doing the decoupling from gravity of these pi interactions. But I can also do a perturbative expansion in terms of the Goldstone mode perturbations. And we're going to find extra contributions here, which seems slightly problematic when you start thinking about it, because they involve what looks like non-local operators. And these non-local operators should make us feel slightly uncomfortable with wall situation. And there's actually two things which should be slightly unexpected from the effective field theory viewpoint. The first of which is that I'm adding here an S boundary. And the reason I'm doing that is that I know that there are works in which the initial states are not really Bunch-Davis, and the information of what initial states you had during inflation can be encoded in the boundary effective field theory. And as a point of principle, in effective field theories, we don't really care about boundary terms. We just write things in terms of the bulk action. So that's the first thing that is slightly uncomfortable. But the second one, as I mentioned, is, I think, slightly worse.
Sorry, by boundary, you mean a space-like surface?
At a specific time, yes. So like these non-Bunch-Davis vacuum initial conditions that we can keep track of them just by saying that I'm focusing on a specific time and not going to minus infinity.
Yeah. I mean, cosmology, it's not true that we don't care about those boundaries. No? So when you compute the cosmological correlation functions, if we have a boundary at t equals minus something.
That's right. So the way of taking that into account can be to add a boundary. That's all I'm saying. But as a point of principle, when writing the effective field theory, in principle, we wouldn't have thought, oh, okay, I need to remember that there's an S boundary as well.
So by boundary here, you mean boundary in time, not boundary in the space. Or do you mean boundary in the space as well?
So I mean a boundary in time. So for a specific instance of times, it's an hypersurface that is defined for t equals something.
But that's also non-local in the space, right? Those terms. So that would be impressive.
These terms, you mean?
Yeah.
Right, so...
I mean, if you encode initial condition,
right. It's non-local. Yes. And the other point is that this seems also very non-local. So we start getting from the effective field theory viewpoint something like one over box. I think the first time that I noticed this, I was really very confused and thought that I didn't know how to calculate non-Gaussianities anymore. But actually, the true is that these are not traditional effective field theories, right? So the zeta really is not the scalar. It encodes information about the metric. And the reason why we're getting things like one over box is because whenever we do cosmological perturbation theory, we solve for the constraints of the lapse and the shift and for the cubic action. Actually, what happens is that it's enough to go to first order in the zeta, which is this perturbation. It's what controlling the perturbation and the wall theory.
It's not the box, it's Laplacian.
Yes, I'm just simplifying. And that
it's a bad simplification because it has a different implication.
It has, and it gives all sorts of things, but D minus two. So the point that I want to make is that once you solve for the shift, you basically find things which appear to be non-local acting on the zeta. And if you plug this thing into the action, which is what we usually do, that's why we're getting these non-local looking operators. And again, the reason is because I shouldn't really be alarmed, because these effective field theories are fundamentally gravitational. These all what look like a pathology is just only arising because I'm solving for the shift. And importantly, causality is not violated. So even though it looks like a very nasty operator, once I calculate the retarder propagator, outside light cone is just going to vanish, as it should, so everything is under control. So there are many...
Not that when you say gravitational, I mean, what you mean is that there is a gauge zero model. Even for electromagnetism, I will get the same thing when you solve for a zero.
Exactly. So the zeta is not just including... I could have done the same thing with pi when I went to next order in slow roll. So the zeta is not just the scalar part of the field, the scalar field fluctuations, but it also includes information about the metric. And that's where all the trouble is coming from.
But I want to object to that. I thought the idea of effective field theory is that you don't know about the theory. You want to write down everything that's possible according to some rule.
Exactly. And
so
I would have
know what it is.
But I would have thought that operators like this, I would never write them down because they could arise, you know, as integration of massless particles, like we talked the other day. But as
not this one, now this again, because it's not a box, it's a special class.
Yeah, yeah, this is a gauge effect. This is just because it's a zero equal to zero. Same thing. There is nothing special to gravity.
There's
nothing.
Yes. Zero.
But I guess I'm just saying, is it then clear about the rules that, because in effective field theory, the rules are that you write all the local operators. And now here, if you want to write the most general effective field theory in this language, there are operators that are not, at least on their face, are not local.
And the rules are you have to write all the eigenvariant things. It's harder to do it in this case.
No, but effective field theory of inflation is not.
Well,
you're breaking
local,
some of the gauges.
But the rules are always the same. It's simply that you should apply the rules before integrating out N and N I, you know, and that's how effective your equation works.
Okay, saying it before integrating N and N I, you should everything
local with respect to the symmetries, and then when you integrate them out, you get these effects.
Exactly. So at least these are subtleties that maybe we should start revisiting so that we understand really all these theories come about. So let me just finish by saying that in these theories, we're really looking at screening solutions or solutions in which there's a really a Weinstein mechanism operating. And the whole division of the effective field theory, the description that we're making is that we have a low energy description, and then we have a collection which could be either important or unimportant of operators which can be made arbitrarily large and actually correct these interactions at level of the low energy description. And the whole point is that if we want to make sense of these theories on the basis of the tools that I've just described, then these effective field theories make sense as long as I acknowledge that there's a hierarchy that is embedded on derivatives acting on the background. So the Weinstein mechanism is at the heart of understanding all this. And I believe it's a bottom-up exercise in the sense of asking us the fundamental questions that the theory has. Not only to understand supraluminal propagation, whether we should allow those whenever we do a cosmological analysis, and we should actually allow dual parameter theory space and then fix that with observations, or whether there's a real obstruction to considering C as, for example, larger than one in theories of inflation, for example. It's also at the heart of understanding the screening effect. So there's this freezing of very, very big, large backgrounds. It also changes what we mean by standard effective field theory rules. So what they mean is at least to be spelled out a little bit more clearly, like we've seen with this example of inflation. And it also exposes this problem of technical naturalness. So we like to make sure that when we use models for inflation and we have pre-existing quantum fluctuations, we're not going to ruin all the models and all the predictions that model can have. So let me stop here and thank you for your attention.